This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. When criticism is leveled against Western medicine from those in so-called alternative traditions, there's often the claim that Western science uses a car mechanics approach to human health, focusing on individual parts of the body going bad instead of a more holistic approach. The irony? Today's guest was a car mechanic before becoming a doctor. Several years into medical training, he began criticizing Western medicine in a similar fashion. Then he started looking for a unifying theory of disease. Among his conclusions so far, key factors in almost all illness include the goings-on in our digestive tracts and a condition he calls inflammation. Curious to hear more? Internist, endocrinologist, and founder of the Revolution Health Center, Zachary Bush, has agreed to address your questions right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. In our culture today, is there one thing most likely behind all manner of ill health? Could it be diet? Is it stress? How about lack of exercise? Or might there be some factor largely beyond our control that most of us may not even know about? Our guest has thoughts on all these questions, and we'll ask him to start sharing in just a few moments. But if you've got insights to offer or related questions to ask, I do hope you'll join us at 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that comes out to 888-967-2825. Today's guest is board certified in hospice and palliative care, internal medicine, and endocrinology. He's founder of a private practice clinic in Scottsville, Virginia, that goes by the name Revolution Health Center. And it is a great pleasure to see him here in the Insight Studio, Dr. Zach Bush. Thank you for making time for us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Well, Zach, I know that you have much to say on what you believe are root causes of a myriad of health problems in our world today. But before we get to that, I was hoping we could hear a bit more about your personal background. And as I understand it, there was something that happened for you when, as a young man, you spent some time in the Philippines. So could you tell us some of that story and how it relates to the work that you do today?
Yeah, I expect many of us travel journeys that we wouldn't be able to write when we're in high school planning out our futures, and our lives take many left-hand turns, like Wile E. Coyote and the left-hand turn in Albuquerque, I think. But my left-hand turn happened with a trip to the Philippines, where I was able to work in a pre- and postnatal care clinic with an aunt of mine who was working with a group of international midwives. And
this was a missionary center?
I'm not sure that it was considered a missionary center, the actual clinic there. My aunt and uncle were missionaries there. My uncle was doing church support throughout the Asian area, including in the Philippines there. My aunt was working with this group there, but I suspect you could call it a missionary organization there. Yeah.
And up until this time, as I understand it, you, as I'd mentioned earlier, you did a lot of work as a car mechanic. You actually, in high school, had a business restoring antique cars. By the time you got, I guess, to your first year of college there in Colorado, where you grew up, you're thinking that you might translate that into some work in the field of engineering,
mm-hmm.
and then you arrive in the Philippines. So take us through what happens next.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so exactly that background, thinking about mechanics and robotics and engineering as kind of a field that I might have some potential interest in, and then showed up there in the Philippines and was my first exposure to real adverse poverty in the developing world there. And in the first couple of hours in this clinic, a lot of these young Filipino mothers handing me these premature and undernourished babies to take care of in some form or fashion without any medical training or anything else, I was struck by an incredible trust and care that was portrayed between these practitioners and these women and these little babies. And so I was intrigued by that human connection. And by the end of the 6 months there, I really felt like I would be unable to go backwards after having experienced that and had to move forward towards a more human connection with whatever profession I was going to pursue.
And how did medicine come into your life?
Through that same avenue. I was within a couple weeks of showing up in the Philippines, the midwife from Canada that was in charge of the 14-day checkups was called back to Canada for some family emergencies, and I was quickly trained to take on that role for doing these 14-day health screenings for these little babies, and that it was a bug I couldn't shake. It was a really exciting time for me to realize that I could quickly be brought up to speed with a concise amount of knowledge that I could immediately apply to a human body and figure it out, and it tied right back into my old engineering days.
So you went back to college in Colorado, finished your undergraduate degree, went right on to medical school, and then ended up in Virginia for your first residency?
That's correct, yeah. So I did internship and residency at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville.
And that was in internal medicine?
Internal medicine, yes.
But you've added some more credentials since then?
Correct. So internal medicine is a three-year subspecialty in medicine that is really adult chronic care, anything from your general internist doing your primary care type role to the foundation for cardiology and renal nephrology, the pulmonary doctors as well. So it's really a foundational leaping point for those other subspecialties. And so I did the 3 years of internal medicine and went on to do a chief resident year after that, which was a year of teaching and research, and then did 3 years of endocrinology and metabolism thereafter.
What is endocrinology?
Endocrinology is the study of hormones and the communication networks between systems within the body. And so it's a big connection between the brain and the organs that put out hormones, and these are often referred to as glands. And so the connection between the brain and the master gland, as we call it, which is the pituitary gland up in the base of the brain, that then runs much of the show in the body in regard to big regulatory factors, factors as to how we metabolize our food, how we manage stress. All of these things are really run by this endocrine hormone communication network.
Why did you decide to specialize in endocrinology? Was it by this time that you were becoming dissatisfied with what you were seeing in traditional Western medicine, or was it after you got into research in endocrinology?
Yeah, it was a continued pursuit. You know, 3 years of endocrinology, I'm sorry, 3 years of internal medicine, and then, you know, teaching for a full year was a really deep immersion in some of the minutiae and details of the science behind what we were doing in medicine. Left me with a real craving for more information. I didn't feel like I had reached any root cause of human disease at the point. It was getting more and more complicated and fractured as I learned more, rather than a cohesive model of what health looked like. The endocrine system seemed to offer a possible solution to that, looking towards a communication network to the body, starting to try to understand a bigger system that was maybe cohesive. And it was after a few years of delving into that and doing further research that took me into the cancer studies that really started to show me that even the hormones were not telling the whole story, and there was a deeper story of communication that must be the cohesive source there somewhere. So it's been a steady kind of going down the rabbit hole of what is the root cause of disease first, and then in the last 4 years, really a bit much deeper hole, which has been what is the root cause of health.
In terms of that first issue, the root cause of disease, which is part of what led you into the field of endocrinology and the research that you were doing even while you were still at UVA, did you find an answer?
At that point, I started to get glimpses of it, yeah. And those glimpses were around this topic of a breakdown in cellular communication and understanding that there was a process called inflammation that's broadly referred to as inflammation in the body, and that was starting to look like a root cause at that point. With that root cause, it was clear that, you know, I was starting to see some similarities between what was going on under the microscope in the cancer cell that's dividing or failing to respond to therapy, similar to a diabetic who's sitting in my office clinically and experiencing a loss of communication between their foot and their spine with this neuropathy developing, and they can't feel their feet anymore. So I was starting to really realize there was this breakdown in communication was a real fundamental piece of the missing cohesiveness that I was looking for.
Well, I've heard you say before, Zach, that inflammation is the root cause of all human disease.
Yeah, it's a pretty bold statement, I suppose, in the sense that there's the word all in there. And the reason why I've come to that is that when you look up inflammation in something like the Webster's Dictionary, they say something like, well, it's the response to an injury where there's some redness and swelling around a toe that's been stubbed. That's the macro version of inflammation. That certainly is an example or a description of what you see. But at the micro level, under a microscope, what you're seeing is really a breakdown in communication. And so that is why I really believe that it's accurate to say that any disease or disorder of the body is going to ultimately dial back down at some point to this breakdown in communication, which leads to this inflammatory pathologic response, which causes secondary injury.
So when somebody hears you, Dr. Zangbusch, say that you see inflammation as the root cause of all human disease, if we're not trained in the same way you are, and we hear the word inflammation, are we thinking something completely different than what you mean?
I think not. I think you may be thinking on a larger scale, like that red elbow after you've twisted it or injured it. That's an inflammation that's visible and easy to understand. And in fact, that's exactly what's going on at the micro level under a microscope as well. So I think ultimately the understanding of inflammation
is... When you say, Zach, all human disease, you're talking about cancer, you're talking about diabetes, you're talking about Alzheimer's, you name some of the things that you're talking about, if you would.
Absolutely. So we can actually look at the human population right now in the United States and the epidemics of chronic disease that we now have and really tease this out to a pretty accurate degree as to what happens over the course of a lifetime of inflammation. And so if we look at our children, we see a very predictable pattern going on where we have attention deficit. We have this breakdown in concentration at the brain. And so perhaps the earliest indication of stress or inflammation, those two words pretty much synonymous at the cell level, the first signs are this attention deficit process. And then as that body continues to be exposed to the same stress or inflammation over time, we see kind of a predictable course where that what starts as kind of an attention deficit or a lack of short-term to long-term memory processing, something like that, can turn into more of an anxiety disorder in your teens. It can be major depression by late teens, early 20s. On the metabolic side, where we're seeing more the endocrine hormone side get involved in that exposure to chronic inflammation, we see precocious puberty happening in a lot of children by the mid-teens.
And that means early onset.
Early onset puberty.
Most people listening probably knew exactly what you meant, but I want to make sure I did.
I appreciate you clarifying that exactly. So early premature onset of puberty, and then some infertility issues setting in the mid-teens with something called polycystic ovarian syndrome, now thought to affect 1 in 4, 1 in 5 young women in America. So that kind of translating then as an early predictor of type 2 diabetes. So in this whole spectrum as the decades tick by of inflammation leading to insulin resistance, polycystic ovarian syndrome, type 2 diabetes. You keep marching down those pathways, then you're going to get into the heart disease, vascular disease stuff, which includes chronic kidney disease, heart disease as we think of it with the heart attacks, strokes. And then as you continue down that pathway of inflammation, you get into cancer. And then if you've survived the heart attack, strokes, and cancer risks and have gotten through to that point, then you're looking back at the brain, just where we started with attention deficit. Long-term inflammation of the brain, we see all the degenerative conditions, which can be things like Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, dementia, as mentioned.
How much of the medical community would you estimate at this point in time accepts your view as you've just explained it?
Oh, I think that's a widespread understanding that inflammation ultimately is... there. I think that the aha moment for me wasn't so much that inflammation was important. I had certainly been taught a lot about inflammation and its pathways, especially in the research world of cancer. We talk through what are these reactive oxygen species and things like this at the cell level. A lot of that's common knowledge. I think where the flip happened, if my paradigm flipped, was around the simplicity of the whole message of I no longer have to worry about a patient walking in with cancer versus Alzheimer's versus attention deficit versus polycystic ovarian syndrome. I actually can just look at everybody walking into my clinic as some version or another of inflammation, and that has simplified my medical practice radically.
And part of where you look, if I understand correctly, is what is happening in the human digestive system, which may also give people hope if they're thinking, well, maybe this doctor is onto something, and if I can change what's going into my digestive system, maybe things will get better. And you're nodding your head, so we'll get you to talk more about that when we get back here on Virginia Insight in just a bit more than 1 minute. As a teenager, he had his own business as a part-time auto mechanic and rebuilder of antique cars. But for close to 20 years now, his focus has been human health and medicine. Endocrinologist Dr. Zachary Bush is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. If you have a question for Dr. Bush or you want to react to anything that you've heard him say so far, you're welcome to join the conversation at 888-967-2825. That's easy to remember as 888-WMRA-TALK. So the other statement that I've heard from you in the past, Zach Bush, is in addition to inflammation being a root cause of all human illness, that a huge portion of the problems that we have, at least in our society, that lead to that inflammation, that lead to illness, are the goings-on in our digestive systems.
Very good, yes. This has been a massive focus of our center at Revolution Health Center, as well as all of the research at New Earth Dynamics. There's been a very cohesive and growing body of medical science and literature around the topic of nutrition over the last 40 years, and this has led to a real understanding that the foods that we put in our mouth has direct relationship with this inflammation that we were just talking about. And depending on what we put in our mouth, we tend to increase or decrease that amount of inflammation in our body. And so that was where things really started to shift for me at the university level, when I started to realize that the toolbox that I had been given to manage type 2 diabetes in my endocrine clinics, or type 1 diabetes as well, was insulin and medications that increase the amount of insulin our bodies make, etc. None of the medications I was using were really getting at any root cause of the gut or inflammation per se. They were all kind of downstream dealing with some of the consequences there. And so I was given a toolbox of pharmaceutical agents that were really doing chronic disease management in the form of Band-Aids rather than some sort of root cause management of what may have led this patient to having diabetes to begin with. A book came across my desk from a patient, actually, called Dr. Neil Barnard's Program for Reversing Diabetes. This was probably eight years ago or something like that, and handed me the book and said, "You need to read this. I really would like to do this program." A little bit embarrassed to say at this point, but I actually thought, oh, that sounds a little bit like bunk. Nobody reverses type 2 diabetes. And so at that point in my training and everything else, I had failed to hear that message that perhaps changing the way we eat might reverse a disease process. So read the book in two or three nights and was compelled immediately by just the simplicity of the message, and realized I had absolutely no knowledge of nutrition or where macro and micronutrients were coming from in our diet and what they were doing once they passed our gums. And so that led me down a pretty rapid 3 or 4 months of really trying to figure out what was some of the basic nutrition around his thesis that if you stopped eating meat and dairy, type 2 diabetes might go away. Seemed too simple and too good to be true, but that rapidly led me down a lot of research, reading that had been done over the last 30 years, taking us back to the 1960s at Cornell with the research being done there that ultimately led to the China study, or the research coming out of the Georgetown area that led to Dean Ornish's book, Reversing Cardiovascular Disease, back in the 1990s there. So quickly realized, wow, and not only did I not know nutrition, I didn't realize it was being studied to this incredible depth of science. And so those some of the turning points in my own education, I suppose, or exposure that started taking me back to the human gut. And that's where we now thrive at the clinic, is really thinking around this issue of nutrition. And so started working with some colleagues at the University of Virginia trying to set up a plant-based diet approach to dealing with diabetes and chronic disease there. And because of some of the challenges working in a large system like that, was unable to bring that to fruition. And so ultimately left in 2010 and started the center in Scottsville, Virginia, which is Revolution Health Center. And so there we really started delving into a much more in-depth understanding of how hard we could push with nutrition and how high could we ask our patients to jump to really transform their lives and really ask them to really do some really challenging changes with their lifestyle. And what we found is, in some ways, the more challenging we made it, the more intriguing and exciting it got for the patients, because their results were getting to be more obvious much faster.
Well, let me back up for just a moment, if I could, Dr. Zach Bush. because this statement that I've heard from you in the past about how much disease and illness is associated with the goings-on in our digestive system is more, if I understood you correctly, Zach, than just what food passes through our lips into that digestive system. Because I think I've also heard you say that food does not really feed the body. What it does is feed the bacteria in the gut.
Yeah. Yeah, so now you're fast-forwarding through my own education there some. So it turns out, as you know, started Revolution Health Center and was reading through all these books of plant-based diet, eat lots of kale, broccoli, collards. That seemed obvious, and that seemed like a good idea. But quickly realized that that wasn't translating immediately to improvement in my patients. What was happening often is, especially among my sicker patients, feeding them healthy foods was actually pretty noxious to them. They were having a really hard time digesting it. They were experiencing bloating, changes in their bowels that were unpleasant, a lot of abdominal discomfort, even brain fog, other things going on. And so that's when, you know, I started to have to dig a little deeper as to, okay, maybe just kale isn't the only answer to what's going on. Maybe we can put healthy food on the plate. It doesn't necessarily immediately result in health in the body. Why is that? And that got me down to this story of what's become a daily topic. Almost every day now there's another news article coming out or some medical journals saying something about the fact that bacteria are fundamental in our understanding or in the root causes of disease and are fundamental in our process towards understanding where health might come from. So we have, as a clinic and as a research group, been really delving into this understanding that maybe there is actually something more than the human body, and it's actually more of a human ecosystem. And so we're referring to this as the human biome now in our work, and this understanding that there's an enormous ecosystem that in a healthy state would teem with more than 30,000 species of bacteria and fungi and yeast and all kinds of things there, not just in the gut, but on our skin and elsewhere. And we are grossly outnumbered by these bacteria. We may have 70 trillion cells on the human level, but there's more than a quadrillion bacteria in a healthy body. And so we are grossly outnumbered, and there's researchers now coming out of UCLA and elsewhere estimating that 90% of the enzymatic work done in the human body is actually done by a bacteria. And so it looks that our health is really fundamentally founded on this greater biome rather than just the human cells and the diseases that might manifest in those human cells.
Internist, endocrinologist, as well as doctor of palliative medicine, Zachary Bush, MD, is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We do have phone lines open at 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that's 888-967-2825 if you want to join the conversation. However, if you'd rather type instead of talk, there is another way to reach us. You can post to us on the Virginia Insight Facebook page, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And we have this post, Zach, from Heidi, who says, I do suspect that inflammation is a much bigger problem than many realize. Please ask your guest to talk about how to recognize when and where in the body you have inflammation and what to do to make it go away.
Very good, Heidi. I think that actually this takes us back to right the topic we were just on, which is the gut. And so you're right that inflammation is a much bigger problem than most of us walk around thinking about in a day. Inflammation, again, this breakdown of communication at the cell level, this process of cellular repair mechanisms being overwhelmed and having to start to rely on the immune system for kind of chaos control to kick in. And the symptoms of it, I think we can look back to kind of that description of some of the processes of over the lifetime and in our current American population. What are our children experiencing with things like attention deficit disorder and autism? What are our adults experiencing with everything from cancer rates that are now reaching 1 in 2 to this Alzheimer's dementia process and things like this? The symptoms are really very much getting back at exactly how I describe inflammation or the definition of inflammation, which is a breakdown in communication.
A breakdown in communication between?
Between just about any system. And so one of the most common symptoms coming into my clinic now is fatigue. Many people complaining of fatigue, which can come in two forms, a mental fatigue, which can be described as brain fog sometimes, where there's a disconnect. You just can't quite process information. It's hard to create short to medium-term memory. it's difficult to do executive function, or there's the physical fatigue, feeling that malaise and kind of deep aching state that you can experience when you're recovering from the flu. These kinds of states of disconnect where we can feel outside our body or outside our own mind. So that's kind of the macro version of disconnection that is really literally
so
the symptom of inflammation.
So what's not communicating? What cell to cell is not communicating? My digestive system's not communicating with my big toe? Mm-hmm. I don't understand where the breakdown in communication is.
Very good question. Yeah, so, and that's actually really what my whole education was about. I was digging deeper and deeper and deeper to figure out what is the network of communication and what the heck is the disconnect and how do we get it plugged back in. And I thought for all the world, once I was a couple years into endocrinology, that, oh, it's the hormones have got this thing. And if a hormone is no longer communicating or being produced by a gland, then we have a breakdown in communication and you can develop low thyroid or type 1 diabetes. And that seemed like a reasonable explanation at the time. But then you start asking, well, why did the gland fail? What is the disconnect deeper? And the answer is becoming pretty compelling. The answer is that there is a communication network that is being produced by bacteria. This is our work at New Earth Dynamics. Or mitochondria, which look a lot like bacteria, except they're much tinier. 200 mitochondria in every single human cell. And these mitochondria have their own genome, their own DNA that looks a lot like the DNA of a virus or a bacteria. And they proliferate and thrive inside of our cells and help produce energy and manage the longevity of the cell. And so we have these two populations, the bacteria and the mitochondria, that are actually making a newly recognized family of communication molecules. And these are broadly being referred to as redox molecules, or this is short for reduction in oxidation, which is the biochemistry description of positive and negative charge. And so it turns out that the really fundamental communication down at the cellular level happens to be a domino chain, if you will, of positive and negative charge communication networks. And so if you have a cut at the skin level and you need to go and start repairing that, first you need to get the message to the bloodstream that an injury has occurred and you need to mobilize the immune system. That already is relying on these redox molecules that are being produced by mitochondria and on the skin bacteria. And these redox molecules are now trafficking across tissue planes and into the bloodstream to signal an alert and start the cell repair. And so fundamentally, it looks like that there's these two communication networks in carbon and in oxygen that are really fundamental in our understanding of how cell injury is recognized and how cell repair begins. And so our protection and repair mechanisms are very much dependent on this deep communication network of positive and negative charge molecules.
The founder of the Scottsville, Virginia-based Revolution Health Center, Dr. Zachary Bush, is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. I want to get back to another aspect of Heidi's question here in a moment, if I could, Zach. But I just want to double check. If we draw links between what you've said so far, is it correct to be thinking that this cellular or even subcellular within a cell failure in communication in your mind is related to some sort of inadequacy with what's happening with bacteria in our digestive tract?
Correct. And so this communication network that's produced by the bacteria is diverse. And so we probably have over a couple million different types of these carbon molecules that are produced by bacteria and fungi and all the rest. And each species of bacteria likely make their own group of these communication molecules. When we have a diverse species, some 30,000 species booming in a chunk of soil that we're growing our food in or in our human gut, we can mobilize an enormous amount of communication. We can traffic an enormous amount of nutrients across membranes. We can do a lot of management with that communication network. But as we lose bacteria, we start to lose some of these fundamental building blocks of that communication network.
So what you're talking about is there not being enough of the right kind of bacteria in people in our culture, because you have specified it sometimes that this is predominantly a Western problem and especially an American problem. If somebody has a health problem, from your point of view, if you flip over what you've been saying and look at it from the other direction, if somebody has a health problem, you would conclude almost automatically that they don't have enough of the right kind of healthy bacteria in their digestive tract.
That's correct. And actually, this is getting very specific now. There's a number of groups around the world now that have shown that specific cancers, such as colon cancer or breast cancer, can be predicted by changes in specific species within the intestines. And so we are increasingly understanding that, exactly as you say, if we see disorder or disease in a body, we can immediately assume that there's been a disruption in the normal ecosystem or complex relationships of those bacteria in the gut of the human we're looking at.
So the other part of Heidi's question was, could we get Dr. Bush to talk about how to recognize when and where in the body you have inflammation and what to do to make it go away? Well, I guess those are two parts. The first part I was thinking about, Heidi, is your question of when and where in the body it's occurring. If I understand Dr. Bush correctly, what you're saying is you have any illness, if you have headaches, if you have migraines, if you have eczema, if you have asthma, there's inflammation in your body.
There's inflammation, and there's probably a disruption in that communication network in the gut. And so we can really tie this back, and you mentioned just a moment ago, which is important, that this has really seemed to be a Western problem. This has been a problem within the United States, seeming to really lead the charge on this chronic disease epidemic. Where our group has really turned the story back to is post-World War II. And so as we came out of World War II, we had this huge machine that was doing all this petroleum-based science. We no longer needed demand on the war front for that, and so this petroleum-based science really turned to farming, and we started to destroy the soil of the United States. We did this by eliminating thousands of years of practice of farming and going to nitrogen-based petroleum fertilizers. At this point, we started to lose bacterial diversity in the soil, and we started to wipe out some of the biodiversity we probably had on the planet before that. At the same time, we started to develop herbicides and pesticides that were then direct toxins to the bacteria in the soil. As we started losing that bacteria in the soil, we started losing nutrients in the plant. This carbon molecule system that we're working on in New Earth Dynamics seems to be the answer as to how that works. If you lose the carbon matrix, you no longer have the ability to traffic nutrients across that root fiber. It's very similar to how it's very difficult to get nutrients from the human gut into the bloodstream if you don't have the bacteria sufficient. And so the soil started to die in the 1950s and 60s and developed all of the fertilizers and everything else that would be part and parcel to that. And now we have factory farming on a grand level that's doing amazing work to eliminate anything that resembles the soil we may have had thousands of years ago. And that led to this lack of nutrient in the plant. Once we lacked nutrients in our food system, there was less and less demand for us to have biodiversity in our intestines. And so as we push towards monoculture on our plate, we get monoculture in our intestines, and that's partly just by selective bias there. Five nutrients end up with five species of bacteria. You have 5,000 nutrients in the plant, you get 5,000 species. So monocultures across our plants into our gut are really maybe the fundamental injury that we currently have as a people.
Zach, I got to tell you that I think I've missed a few steps here, but there may be people listening who are right with you and they have advanced questions they want to ask you, and we do have phone lines open at 888-WMRA-TALK. But I want to go back, if I can, to get you to explain more of what you've come to conclude is happening in our digestive systems that is bad for us, and then also to Heidi's last part of her question, what we can do about it. So we'll do all that and more when we get back from the break. Internist, endocrinologist, as well as doctor of palliative medicine, Zachary Bush is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Inflammation, root cause of all disease. A lot of what causes inflammation and leads to ill health comes from the misworkings of what's going on in our digestive system. And the misworkings of what's going on in our digestive system has a lot to do with how the soil that the foods we eat comes from is different today than it was 50 or 60 years ago. Is that a fair assessment of what you've told us so far, Zach Bush?
That's a fair assessment, and it's taking us into the next piece of that puzzle. So,
before you get there, I'm curious how you know that what's going on in somebody's digestive system involves there not being enough of the right kind of bacteria. Do you actually cut open a piece of intestine and put it under a microscope? Or is this speculation based on all kinds of deductive reasoning?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, up until recently, it was a lot of deductive reasoning, but we've now have the advantage of the genome, and so we're able to actually do genome sequencing of the bacteria within complex systems and get a fingerprint, if you will, of a larger ecosystem. And so there's a number of assays that can now be done commercially. You can actually send a stool sample to a national lab and get a fingerprint of the genome or to get a sense of which bacteria you do have in your gut, what's the general biodiversity there. These are far from the end product. They get better every year. Our understanding of that biodiversity improves each year, but we really are getting objective measures of this loss of biodiversity in the human body.
So your conclusion that there's something wrong, at least with many Americans' digestive systems, in terms of the kind and quality of bacteria in our intestines, is based on seeing things under a microscope?
Sure, you can do that through a number.
Well, I'm asking about your conclusions, because you got to understand, Zach, that you are making statements that some people may have a little bit of difficulty accepting and saying to themselves, well, my doctor never talks about this kind of stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah, so yeah, I think I'm talking a lot of broad terms with pretty radical words like all and global kind of inclusiveness to human disease and understanding of it. I think that you can speak with most physicians now, and they're going to point more and more every week that goes by to the human gut in whatever field they happen to be in, whether it's oncology with cancer or whether it's asthma and allergy in the children.
But it sounds like, based on what you're saying, that if somebody was to travel to somewhere in Africa where they don't use American methods of agriculture and they haven't been using chemical-based fertilizers, and you took a look at what was going on in the bacteria in their intestines, it would, according to your theories, be healthier than what's happening in most Americans' intestines.
Absolutely. And you can see that actually because of
the... So what I'm wondering is if anybody's actually done those kinds of tests.
Sure. I mean, to my knowledge, I haven't seen large population studies looking at stool ecosystems in Africa at this point. But what we do know is that most of the studies have been done between EU countries and the United States. The EU has worked very hard to reduce the amount of genetically modified crops and other kind of factory farming methods there. And we have a lot of comparisons to what's showing up in their urine and what's showing up in their stool compared to ours. So those are kind of some general studies that have been looked at. The ecosystems of the gut are actually even compared across sections of the United States now by some of these laboratories that are doing widespread genomics testings of the stool.
I cannot tell you how tempted I am to get you to discuss much more about stool ecosystems, being the first time I ever heard that phrase, but we're all of a sudden getting lots of calls, so let's not keep too many of these people waiting. Meredith in Charlottesville, thanks so much for calling in on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Dr. Zach Bush, please.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for the opportunity to participate. My question is based on some experience I have with Chinese diets and recommendations about making things easy on the gut to process food, in the sense that a lot of Eastern dietary practices have. And I'm wondering if sort of the stress that the foods we eat put on our system have anything to do with this sort of bacterial gut-level health that you've been studying.
Dr. Bush.
Yes, so I think I'm understanding your question there regarding Chinese medicine. I'm not clear entirely on what you're referring to there, whether it's the Chinese herbals that are used or a probiotic kind of process. Certainly Chinese medicine has long preached the importance of nutrition and the food that we put in our mouths. Chinese medicine thousands of years back stating that we needed to eat about 80% of our diet in kind of an alkaline fashion from the plants and 20% more from the higher proteins. So that has been longstanding recognition in Chinese medicine and is now, I think, making headway even in Western medicine, realizing that food we put in our mouth is definitely linked to our relative health or lack thereof it. And we're increasingly understanding that part of that is because of the food we put in our mouths predicts the bacteria we have in our gut. And so when you're eating a plant-based nutrition that's really based on vegetables as your main source, that the vegetable fruit world is really where we see the vast majority of the micronutrients. The skin of a sweet potato being a really good example of almost complete source for almost every micronutrient the body needs. And so that skin of the sweet potato really forces a really diverse ecosystem within the gut to manage it. Whereas if you've got something like a processed piece of white bread or something like that in front of you, you almost have no nutrient diversity. Or if you even look at something like a piece of steak or a glass of milk, the number of micronutrients in those sources is actually quite low. The macronutrients of protein and things like that can be high, the micronutrient diversity low. And so the more micronutrient diversity we get, the lower we eat on the food chain, the more diversity we get in our gut, and the more bacteria we get. As we get more bacteria, we get more of these carbon redox molecules, and we get better communication down there at the immune system.
Meredith, thanks so much for your call. We're going next to Mary in Franklin, West Virginia. Mary, thank you for calling in on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Zach Bush, please.
Hi, Zach. Thank you. My question is about medication and how inflammation can possibly interfere with prescribed medications. I have a family member that's in his late 60s, and he takes a lot of pain medication for like spurs on the spines and herniated discs, that kind of thing. And he takes oxycodone, and in the past, I think, 3 months, more and more, he can't sleep at night. And it doesn't make sense to me, anyway, that he's taking this pain medication, and it's keeping him awake.
Well, you definitely point to one of the common scenarios that we see in the Western medicine world is that any pharmaceutical agent we add to the system tends to come with its own side effects and challenges of managing it. This is kind of the bane of maybe what my existence was when I was prescribing a lot of medications, was spent a lot of time listening to the problems and symptoms my patients were having in regard to those medications, and that remains to this day a real challenge for all of us who are practicing medicine. The pharmaceutical industry has worked hard to kind of understand chronic disease management and its symptom relief, but again, has maybe often missed the idea that inflammation is underlying everything. And one of the challenges the pharmaceutical industry has is that each agent that we tend to make to act as a pharmaceutical agent ends up being positively charged as it is metabolized through the liver or kidneys. And so in some ways, a lot of these pharmaceutical agents are adding to the problem of inflammation in the body.
Yeah, but he's been taking this with, you know, fairly good results for pain for years, and now it seems like all of a sudden he's having trouble sleeping. Like, I mean, no sleep. I thought it was just very strange that it would, you know, almost have the opposite. It's taking care of the pain, but it's acting like a stimulant as far as he can't sleep.
Yeah, so I think that's a possible explanation. I don't know his clinical history well, so there's probably many other potential reasons he's suddenly not sleeping. So I think that would warrant some further conclusions or observation there.
Yeah, we're not going to ask you to diagnose on the air, but when it comes to somebody who's having chronic pain, is that something that you address with diet?
Absolutely, absolutely. So in my work as a hospice and palliative care doctor, we manage pain constantly at the end of life there, and inflammation, again, obviously very fundamental in the process of pain and our interpretation of pain. And so absolutely nutrition, critical piece of the puzzle. And this makes it very hard to walk into a hospital or a nursing home and see what we end up, you know, serving our loved ones in these centers can actually be food that's profoundly inflammatory. And it's very hard to find a nutrient-rich food in a facility like this. And certainly not the fault of the facility necessarily, but there's been a general lack of understanding in the whole industry of health as to the importance of the food that is on the plate.
So, and because we're so short on time, we've only got a couple of minutes left, nutrient-rich food is something that it sounds to me like you try to stress once you get people understanding how important what goes on in their digestive system is. And you gave an example of, what was it, sweet potatoes as a particularly nutrient-rich food?
Correct.
You want to give any more quick examples?
Yeah, so the lower you eat on the food chain is the easiest way to think about it.
The lower you eat on the food chain.
Yep, and if it came from an animal.
So that means things like leafy greens.
Yep, whatever you pick right from the soil. Yep, so your leafy greens right down there at the base of the soil, your peas, your root vegetables, all these really rich in nutrients for sure. And so as you go up the food chain, you start grazing on things that ate vegetables themselves but are no longer a vegetable, your chicken, your beef, your pork. You're suddenly separating yourself from that vast nutrient panel by a couple of degrees, and so you're starting to lose nutrient density as you.
And you include in this dairy products, cheese or milk, is higher up on that chain, and so you think less beneficial than kale.
Profoundly inflammatory, and certainly far less nutrient dense than something like kale.
Mary, I'm so sorry that we are short on time. We want to see if we can make time for at least part of Stephen's call in Charlottesville. Stephen, thank you for calling on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Dr. Bush, please.
Hi, I am actually a wellness coach, and I have sort of diagnosed my family with non-celiac gluten sensitivity disorder. My wife has multiple sclerosis, and I kind of suffer some of like the swelling of joints after eating gluten, and I was wondering what the advances in science has shown us of the relationship between gluten and the gut.
Your answer is spelled out very carefully on our website, newearthdynamics.com. That's exactly the science we've been working on, is this new phenomenon that's really underlying this inflammation process, and this is a process of leaky membranes. And so as we start to lose bacteria, we lose their carbon matrix, their communication network, and we lose the protection of these tight junctions that are in the bowel wall. Tight junctions knit together one cell to the next and create a carpet of membrane that is protective, and that can be at the gut or the kidney or the liver or the blood-brain barrier. And these membranes are now really under threat, and with the loss of bacteria, we've lost our protective mechanism. And now we've created some really dense toxins to these tight junctions, and gluten is perhaps the best known one right now, a naturally occurring compound that's been in the diet for thousands of years, now causing epidemic of sensitivities and beyond, where people are experiencing high levels of inflammation after consuming gluten. The gluten is a toxin to these little tight junctions. As they are weakened, we start to turn into a sieve. What we are working on at New Earth Dynamics is the first supplement of its kind called Restore. It's a carbon redox molecule supplement that takes advantage of those carbon molecules. And what we've been able to demonstrate under the microscope as well as clinically is a really rapid repair to those tight junctions and that leaky membrane effect. And so the epidemic of gluten sensitivity is really pointing back to this lack of bacteria that we've talked about on the show, and a lack of that biodiversity leading to the loss of this communication network that was protecting those membranes. With the loss of protection, we get these toxins, our sensitivities to these potential toxins like gluten. Yeah, even more widespread than the gluten is the weed killers, the herbicides that we use in factory farming, especially across genetically modified crops, have a compound in there called glyphosate, and that is a real potent toxin to those same tight junctions leading to those leaky membranes.
Stephen, thanks so much for your call. We have this from Heather on our Facebook page, Dr. Bush, that may have been posted a little earlier. You may have already answered her question, but let me just read. She says here, how do you get the healthy bacteria into your digestive system that Dr. Bush has been talking about if you are a vegan? Can you? It sounds like what you've been saying is that vegans are much more likely to have more of the right kind of bacteria than meat eaters.
Precisely. And so the more biodiverse your diet, and certainly you can have an unhealthy vegan. You can eat potato chips all day long and call yourself a vegan. But the reality is, if you're really basing your day-to-day on really, you know, those leafy vegetables and as low on that food chain as possible with as much diversity on the plate as you can find, that's where you're going to get the biodiversity back in your gut through sheer demand. Another exciting concept that's relatively new to the field.
I need to ask you, because we're almost out of time.
Sure.
What do you eat in a typical day?
Yeah, so the morning often starts with grains, and so something like a chia pudding where you're getting seeds or grains into a coconut milk base, something like that is a really good start to the day where you're getting a diverse amount of macro calories or macronutrients.
Chia pudding,
yeah, okay. Chia seeds rehydrated in a coconut milk. And then you're going after micronutrients to put into that macronutrient environment of your fat and sugar kind of base that you'd be getting from a coconut milk kind of base. And those micronutrients might come from something as simple as blueberries and almonds. So the skin of the almond having some very unique micronutrients in there.
I got 20 seconds left for you to tell me about lunch and dinner or snacks.
So snacks, again, you're looking at as many vegetables and fruits as possible. And so you're pouring through the day with your cucumbers and then your colors. So everything from your carrots and celery to your bell peppers out into the diversities of the salads you're looking at for lunch and everything else. And then dinner, a really good look is the soups. The more color in that plate or bowl, the better you're going
to
do.
Is there anything that you find hard to resist that you really indulge in once in a while?
Indulgence. That would be dark chocolate.
We'll have to ask you to come back to tell us much more about that. Our guest has been internist, endocrinologist, and palliative care specialist, Dr. Zach Bush, founder of the Revolution Health Center in Scottsville, Virginia. Zach, thank you so very much for your time.
Thank you, Tom.
Podcasts of this program are available on the Virginia Insight tab at WMRA.org. When you get to the page for today's broadcast, you will see links to more information about Dr. Bush and the work that he is doing. Virginia Insight's executive producer, Matt Bingay, Dan Easley, our technical director, Bob Levicky, our associate producer. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.